When you hook it up to an actual computer, it'll be louder.
Louder, okay. Yeah.
Okay, so so I'll start with the little sentence I'm supposed to say to start off with, that this is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Major Ray Weber, recorded on March 13th, 2017 in Victoria, B.C., and you're being interviewed by myself, Mercedes Taylor. Major Weber, do I have permission to record this interview?
You do.
Okay. Can I ask you to please state your full name?
James Raymond Weber.
Okay, great. So just to get started, I was going to ask you about just your background, where you're from, where you were born, where you grew up.
I was born in Miami, Manitoba. In 1936, and was on a farm for my early part of my life until I joined the forces in 1955. We were those folks in 1948 before we had power, so I managed to survive those 12 years on a farm. Went to school in Miami. Was about 2 miles, 2.5 miles from where we were born. And I guess that was about it as far as, farm work. The year before I joined the Canadian Forces, or RCAF, I worked for a grain elevator construction gang. Found it was too difficult, so when I saw the sign for the Air Force, yeah. I decided to give it a try.
Did you have any impressions of the military or the Air Force prior to signing?
Well, of course, my uncle was in the Air Force. There were many people in the local area who had been. Most of them I knew were in the Air Force, Second World War.
Okay.
And there was a couple of school acquaintances went to join the Air Force before I did, so it was, military was pretty popular at that time.
So, do you remember exactly how you came to join up, or the day you joined?
Yeah, saw a sign on a fence post going into town, and said, thought that was an opportunity, because the life on the farms at that particular time was getting a little more expensive to get land. The fact that there wasn't enough to keep my father, myself, or my brother led to investigation of something else. And as I said, saw the sign and said, well, I'd always wanted to travel, so I thought I'd give it a whirl.
Yeah.
And that was in March of 19... Well, actually, I just signed up in February and actually went into the RCAF on the 4th of March, 1955. Do you want to just continue on or not?
Sure, you can.
And so I went to Manning Depot in St. John's, Quebec. And I guess it was, 8 weeks in St. John's, doing the normal military things, was march and pay attention. And it was probably a lot easier on me than a lot of folks. I went in with a brush cut, so I didn't have to peel off a lot of hair. And I was used to work. Marching and physical exercise was fairly tame. It was a little more interesting in getting acquainted with your 39 roommates, double bunks, but keeping a place cleaned. My mother was pretty up on those things, so it wasn't a shock to me personally, but it was a shock to a lot of folks who had to scrub floors and polish them and do those sort of things. And off of there, I went to Trenton, Ontario, and what they used to call contact training.
Mm-hmm.
And another ride for the summer, and which was just becoming acquainted with an airfield and your acquaintance was we had construction, a lot of it was done with lanterns.
Okay.
So the major part of your task was to pick up, refuel, clean all the lanterns every day.
Yeah.
And be prepared for the evening.
Mm-hmm.
Night flying. And I spent all summer there, and then to Grand Bend, Ontario for the course on air traffic, what they called an aircraft control op, because I wasn't commissioned at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting. I can't remember, it's probably about 25 or 30 folks. It was an airfield which was Second World War.
Right.
But they only had the thing it had on it was one hangar and a barracks sort of thing. And they had their own kitchen, so we spent from then going through, I think, training, of course, was much more hands-on, because there was no computers, no electronics, so everything was done by someone standing there saying, copy this or write that,
okay,
and then hand it in. But it was interesting, and we had to pretend you were an airplane and you'd run around the hangar floor calling in and calling out.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was after the course, it was a case of going out to the unit. And the big scary one at that time was Cold Lake, because it was a relatively new base.
Yeah.
And depending on where you came from, I was used to the winters, so I volunteered to go to Cold Lake, which was a good move on my part, because we had a lot of airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And there was lots of activities, so you got to get pretty well up on anything you'd had training on at that
mm-hmm.
time. We had the training for the CF-100s, and to work into that training, they had B-25s did the airborne intercept training for the aircrew, and they chased expeditors, or they were commonly referred to as bug smashers, as targets.
Okay.
There were T-33s, which were doing the instrument ratings for the aircrew, the pilots,
mm-hmm.
while his backseat guy was getting the airborne intercept corps, or training. The pilots were getting their tickets,
right,
their for IFR work, instrument flight rules work. So they were flying every day. Then there was two courses, one on the basic pilot training for the CF-100s, and then the advanced course, which was they strapped in their airborne interceptor buddies,
mm-hmm.
and then they continued that training. For things, so a normal day at Cold Lake would be pretty close to 20 hours a day,
yeah,
one out flying, as long as the weather, and the weather was pretty good there, except for the odd blowing snow and cold. But we worked a shift, which I really liked, was worked mornings, afternoon, came back in the evening, and worked till night flying was over. And then you were work the following afternoon. So you were really immersed in your activities. Mm-hmm. Again, it was pretty basic what you compared to what you have now, mm-hmm. working in the tower. Everybody had a flight plan. Everybody had to phone in. It was, you'd copied it down, then you had to pass it on to somebody else, and then it took, I figured out one day to have one aircraft depart, and by the time he came back on those things, he had to handle them 12 separate times. Mm-hmm. And we used to, a form we used to keep track of them on, there were 66 entries on a form, and you could often fill it both the morning and afternoon, so it was pretty busy. Mm-hmm. From there, I was lucky to get a transfer to Europe.
Oh, right.
To Marvel, France, and worked in the tower there. I guess the exciting part about going there was went over by ship. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I got the flu before I got on.
No.
And I spent most of the trip in a hospital bed on the ship.
Oh, no.
And my biggest or most memory that I had from that, there was a British nurse on this Cunard Lines, and her claim to fame was that she gave painless needles. And you'd roll over and she had a flat of her hand and she'd whack your butt, give you the needle, and she'd say, "Do you feel that?" Of course not. You were stinging so much.
Right. How long was the trip over?
About 6 days, I think, that time. Yeah. And we landed in Le Havre, got on a train, went to Paris to be redistributed out to the different locations. My impression of France was, well, come see, come saw. Mm-hmm. It was, didn't see it for 3 days after we arrived in Mardel because the fog was down on the ground. Mm-hmm. And, but it was an interesting place. Outside the fog and the rain, which we arrived in the fall year, so there was a lot of rain, and they had a humongous mice problem on the base.
Really?
You walk outside and they'd be scurrying all over the place. But they ran in cycles too, come and go.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we had two squadrons of F-86s and a squadron of SCF-100s. And there was one, we had they had alerts, and you were 1 week on, 1 week off.
Mm-hmm.
And the other bases filled in the week you weren't on. So the activity was pretty hectic at times. There was a lot of airplanes in Europe at that time. We had 75 on our base. We had four bases that were mm-hmm. Canadian. Each one had a same complement of aircraft. Then there was Americans very close to us. And they had probably more than that.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they used to do on a periodic basis was they called a tactical evaluation, they actually had targets, went out and shot them and come back again. And the biggest problem at the basis was to maintain your security
mm-hmm.
and get the aircraft back. And on the final day of an exercise, they used to throw everything, we used to say everything except the hangar doors, flew. The problem was that they all went at the same time, they all had to come back at the same time. And I worked in the tower there for about a year, and then I came back to Canada to go on the ground-controlled approach radar, mm-hmm. Which was a precision landing of aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it exists anymore because there's got much more sophisticated.
Right.
Well, they're not more sophisticated. The beauty of the ground-controlled approach was that in an aircraft, all you needed to do was to be able to receive.
Mm.
You didn't have to be able to have special equipment in your aircraft.
Oh, I see.
And we could get you back on the ground. And I'd say we were quite good at it. We had limits after your training and you got down to 200 feet, a ceiling of 200 feet, visibility of a half mile,
mm-hmm.
which was pretty good. And we did thousands of those runs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the training in back in Borden, Ontario, it was something that doesn't exist anymore. We actually trained with real airplanes and real equipment.
Right.
And the way we did it, we had, by the end of the time you were on the course, you had 200 runs, both what we call traffic, which was lining the aircraft up, and final approaches, which was the actual landing.
Mm-hmm.
But how we did it was that there was only two people on the equipment in the morning, and then there was four people on a course. Mm-hmm. And the other two people went in the aircraft, and you actually flew the radar mm-hmm. approaches
mm-hmm.
and did the radio work with the controller.
Mm-hmm.
I think the beauty, as I saw it, was that you actually knew what the pilots were going through and then
right.
flying around. And so you ended up flying for 200 approaches, and you actually did 200 of your own approaches.
Oh, yeah.
On the ground. The training, we had to align our own equipment. There was a CPN-4 and MPN-11, I don't remember exactly what kind. Interesting again in that now everything is computerized. It lines itself up and does its checks and do things. But
right.
we had a bank of controls under a desk, the one you sat at. And they were, it was 23 or 30. You had to manipulate them, and every time you turned one, it would react on something else.
Mm-hmm.
But you had to do that to align the equipment. It was all logarithmic. So you had a glide slope, a center line on the final part of it. So that was the biggest part of the test, was to be able to manipulate those things and know when they had moved off during the day. Heat would affect the alignments of your equipment. And so that's the first time I ran across air conditioning.
Oh, really?
It wasn't for the bodies, people.
No.
It was to keep the equipment running. So from there, I went back to Marvell and after the course and did radar approaches there until I came home in 1960. Or back to Canada in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
And probably 2,000 or 3,000 runs by the time I come back. Because I used to volunteer and go sit in because I liked to do it.
Right.
a lot of people had been doing it for a lot longer than me. They didn't mind going in. But
do you recall any specific instances of especially challenging situations, or?
Well, it was one of those things. I guess in air traffic control, if you weren't very well suited to do it, it was always very challenging. It's an activity that lends itself to, if you pass good information at the right time, you don't have problems.
Right.
But if you don't do that or can't think that far ahead, then it can become very challenging to individuals. One of the things that I didn't know at the time I did the courses, but I, when I came back on after it was commissioned and was instructing at the time, we had a test that was called spatial orientation. And that's the ability if somebody says, I'm north 3 miles, you can more or less visually or mentally see where that is. It turns out that about 13% of the population has no really spatial orientation capabilities. I have one. I'm married. I mean, if I go to the end of the street and turn right or left, she won't remember that the next time. I mean, this doesn't register. So Victoria is very challenging for my wife because it turns, not all streets are straight.
Right.
They got funny intersections. Where when she was born, she was raised in Winnipeg. Everything was 90 degrees. Well, Toronto.
Yeah, on a grid.
A large grid.
Yeah.
So it was a little easier. There was many days, I guess, where I was controlling these guys, where the biggest thing was fuel. They have a finite amount of fuel. Aircraft over there, the CF-100s weren't so bad, but the Sabres were an hour and a half. They had to come back down if they were gone. The ones that the Brits, when they used to come over, they had what they called NF-11s or Meteors. We always felt that they departed in a state of emergency because they only had 45 minutes of fuel. And technically, when with jets, they needed to be able to come back to their base, fly for 15 minutes, and or to their alternate, whichever. But there was a lot of bases, so it was, alternates weren't too far away. Plus 15 minutes. Well, that means if you had a meteor with only 45 minutes fuel, he flew around a couple of times. He was time to come back, man. But the British were very, I guess, calm about the whole thing. They would check in and say, I'm a bit short. Could you be more specific?
Yeah.
5 minutes. Right. So I just say, descend. And they come in pretty tight. We did to try and have a very quick approach. If for some reason you needed it, we did what we called a practice them all the time. It was a quickie, which means it was basically just a 360 out the end of the runway, around and back down again, but radar controlled. And depending on the weather, it sometimes it had to be. We only did those for real in bad weather, and the guy missed his approach, which got your attention a little bit. But as I said, again, the thing that most people, I think, the ones that were always stressed were ones that shouldn't have been there. They were in the wrong business, and so they couldn't leave it at home.
Right.
One of the things that air traffic controllers should be able to do, and I guess I'm fortunate, is that you leave work at work, you leave home at home, and I used to say to my wife, if unless somebody's dying, I'm at work, you don't phone me. Because I can't do a lot about it, and besides, you're just going to upset. So it was, I think, there was, emergencies were just commonplace. Most of it was fuel, some was fuel-related, others were radio-related. They couldn't, they could hear you in some cases. In most cases, they could hear you, And the way you could do that was that if you just broadcast,
right,
and have an aircraft and turn them right, left, sort of thing, to identify it. And then he, as long as he could listen, then you just brought him back to the base and got him on the ground as soon as you could. But, as I say, it was half a dozen emergencies a day.
Oh.
They would call, you know, because there's a problem. They all, you didn't lose them in the aircraft. It was just a matter of, you treat them with prioritize them. They got number one. Everything. So, and as I said, those, we did some pretty short approaches. The shortest one was if somebody was away off in the boonies and he's coming across, and normally jets would come in, they do what they call a high level, they come in and they pitch out and they come around and land like that. If they were really short of fuel, it was just in the side, one turn to towards the end of the runway, and had enough to get there. Mm-hmm. After leaving Marvell, they had sent me back to Winnipeg, and a different type of radar, but worked in railway radar there with the Department of Transport. The radar was physically located with the Department of Transport there, and it was the civilians had ILS, which was an instrument landing system, but it had our advantage was we could call the ranges more accurate than they could, because there was only an outer beacon and an inner beacon, so that's the only time they knew exactly where they were. And there was a couple of runways in Winnipeg which didn't have it, ILS, so we used to used a lot of force on civilian aircraft. Because even if they didn't pay a lot of attention to the direction, they paid attention to the distance,
right,
because it gave them, you know, what you call it, every half mile, every quarter mile, whatever you wanted, or whatever they wanted. Then they closed out the military radar there, and they run in a civilian, and so that caused another move. And that was, you know, came back in 60, Winnipeg, and then I was there for a year, and then they had needed someone to go to Churchill. Being single, guess who? And it was the same type of radar. By that time, I had met my wife. She didn't think she'd want to go to Churchill, so didn't get married until I came back out.
Oh.
So I went to Churchill for a year, which is very interesting. It was right on the bay. It was fairly active then, because we still had the, what most Canadians were never aware of, is the B-36s used to patrol. There was always one in the air with carrying nukes across the top. They went back and forth and then flew or landed in the States. But if there was the balloon debut, or the balloon, as we used to say, went up, the KC-97s would take up fuel, refuel the bombers, and then they would take off for wherever their target was. And they were always interesting. They changed those over every couple of weeks. From a McGuire Air Force Base. At Churchill itself, the Army was there. We had the rocket range there. And the year I was there, we also did the cold weather testing on the CF-104s.
Okay.
And we had good weather for them, minus 40. And they got all their work done. The time that I was there, I guess the most exciting thing that happened was a B-36 had a, one of the nuke carriers had a problem. And so this was in December, I think it was, when I was working. And he called in and wanted to land, find it's just another aircraft. You know, I mean, on a radar, it just looks like a nothing, you know, just a little blip. Other than if you didn't know, you don't know there's one person, there's 100 people on these things. Right. It just looks the same.
Right.
So I got him in, and they flew in another part overnight. But his question was, what was our weight capability at Churchill? And I said, well, it's really okay right now. We're frozen to the center of the earth in a way. You're not going to sink anywhere out of our thing. But they landed, and then they stood guard about every 15 feet around the aircraft all night.
Wow.
The wobbling wind changing off the people because it was a nuke carrier. Literally, you know, in the scheme of things, other than the military people on the base probably knew it was what was going on. Nobody else would have known because you wouldn't advertise it was down. He was down, but next morning they had already flown apart back up, fixed them, and he disappeared. But I think I'm probably one of the few radar controllers that have a B-52 landing on
That's
records.
Quite impressive, yeah.
But as I said, you know, it's really no different than any other. All got the same treatment, best service that you can possibly give.
Right.
One of the things that used to emphasize, especially with radar, is that when the weather is good, is when you have to tell him exactly where he is.
Oh.
Because he can see.
Right.
So, if you don't say exactly, you know, you're right, left, up, down, whatever, then that's where you build their confidence. Because when they can't see, and you've been, and there were a few sloppy controllers at that time, and well, they can see, but that's not the point. That's where you build your reputation. And when the weather got really bad, the odd guy would ask for a different controller, and he didn't. So that was just it. Even if you'd ever, he has to overshoot. Tell him where, you know, that's where you build your rapport with the air crew. And they would know every, we all had numbers, you know, you couldn't operate in isolation. So we all had numbers. And as I say, that's where you built your reputation. From Churchill after a year in the polar bears, and Walter was back to Winnipeg again. Couldn't seem to escape. And then they back to Transport Canada with the Transport Canada guys. Then that closed out Winnipeg, and I got all the way to Gimli. Back on the same radar I was in, on in Europe. And then Gimli was very busy. We had Tudors and T-33s going pretty well. Every day and night, 6 days a week, 5 days a week, and the odd occasion if they got behind and they're flying. We'd go to the sixth day where they operated the towers and radar. You were available all the time, anyway, even if it went on standby sometimes, but not very often. And in Gimli, we had, I guess, the most interesting place was a fishing shack that we had, the only place we could get to live. Which was interesting in that your furnace was in your bathroom.
How many of you were there?
There was four of us, my two kids and my wife.
Oh, wow.
Very small kitchen unit. It was two steps through the kitchen into the dining room, There was a couple of bedrooms, a sitting room, and a double bed. You couldn't walk around it in the one room. So mm-hmm. the options were you live apart or you live together.
Right.
You always survive, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So after Gimli, which was I was commissioned in Gimli mm-hmm. From the ranks to flying officer, or at least went on the course down mm-hmm. to was it Clinton, and then came back to Gimli while I was away. No, just before I left, went on the course. They moved me to Rivers, Manitoba. So I got the move to Rivers, barely got the furniture in the door of the house and said bye, went on another course. So which it didn't thrill the family all that much. Mm-hmm. As I was gone for, I guess, 8 weeks again, 2 months. In Borden, and again, that's the new training facilities that were not improved a lot by that time. We were still pretending you're an airplane running around the hangar floor, passing information back and forth. But you'd already, by that time, you'd already worked at regular air bases and stuff, so you're, other than there was, felt kind of stupid running around.
Right.
With the speaking back and forth, and they're good. From Borden, they went back to Rivers, and 1 year I went there in Rivers in July, I guess, of 67.
Mm-hmm.
Went on course, went back. Got back there, barely had got checked out there, and I got posted to Portage La Prairie.
Oh, yeah.
So there was, you know, pretty rapid succession. The kids were thinking, mm-hmm. well, where was vacation this year? We were moving to, oh, okay. So I went to Portage. Portage were there for 4 years. It was one of the more interesting spots, too, because of the training. It was training on the Tudor aircraft, the T-33s. We had a whole bunch of C-45s. They were doing the conversion to multi-engine for maritime and transport command. And the initial training was done on musketeers. So it was a interesting things, and we had parallel runways mm-hmm. and crossing runways, and not often defined, but we interwove circuits. Thinking the parallel, they would depart over thing, fly over one runway while aircraft were going underneath, mm-hmm. and they flew out and back around. Amazingly, it worked pretty well. It was sometimes hard to keep track of where everybody was.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's one of those things, if you pick your time is when you're going to say it's passing the right information at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a lot of students,
mm-hmm.
and seldom did they get, well, until they got to be solo and doing it. They always had an instructor on board.
Right.
So, key is talk to the guy who knows what's going on,
mm-hmm.
because he will make sure he stays out of the road,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the ones that perhaps you wouldn't have normally said, you know, talk to, you're not doing that right, or you do this.
Yeah.
The thing was, will he do it? So you take the path of least resistance,
mm-hmm.
talk to the people who know, and they will take care of everything, because they don't want to hurt one another either.
Mm-hmm.
So they will make it work.
Mm-hmm.
So, but again, there was a lot of controllers and stuff. Again, that probably weren't super temperamentally suited
right.
to do that thing, and would get flustered and start yelling at the wrong person.
Mm-hmm.
And compound the problem rather than solve the problem.
What was the technology like at this point?
It's improving.
Yeah.
Radio still had failures. Training hadn't changed a lot. Still all hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody was progressing. It was starting to... Simulators were starting to come in for part of the aircrew training. But it was after Portage... We closed down, and while I was at Portage, I went to the school, back to the school to instruct on the officer's side of it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we still hadn't had any improvements there. We were still back doing everything by hand, by flying around. And there was... some simulation, but it was the old radar simulators that they had there that they were starting to check the officers out in, because up until that time the officers hadn't really done any of the radar activity side of it. And again, with the radar, we still had the JCAs and stuff, and we had a lot of talent in those ones. And so when you're doing the IFR instrument flight rules side of it, it was, again, to use all the talent that was available if you were doing IFR, they were using time, up until that time, still using time to separate aircraft, altitude or time.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would, there seemed to be a mentality certain people wanted to hang on to what thing they didn't feel that they still have control if they give it to somebody else to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was made your life a lot easier if you could have a couple people over there not doing much and you could give them one aircraft each. That's all they had,
right,
to separate and control. But then you could concentrate on something else.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a while for some people. Some people just can't seem to relinquish control. Maybe his name is Trump. But it was an interesting thing. And then that at the school when I was there, we had the first females coming through commission ranks and getting checked out. One of the things that, again, there was people that were selected or who ended up on it, sometimes were just university-trained folks, but they clunked out on whatever they had were previously. They weren't technically selected for air traffic.
Mm.
And some of them, I think, just said, well, I want to be one. So they thought it would be neat. But without any process as to whether they had really much capability or aptitude to do that sort of work.
Mm-hmm.
So when they first few that came through, unfortunately, there was a couple of them weren't very suited, either temperamentally or otherwise, to do it. So it was one of those things where debriefings and stuff were pretty much above board, and they weren't recorded or a thing like that.
Mm-hmm.
We had to set up a system where even if it wasn't two of us in the room, we had to have someone in the next room listening to the conversation, because the odd one would start pulling your... down on me because I'm a woman or a lady, and I said, well, you know, it's not really that, you're just not cutting the mustard sort of thing. One of the things we had trouble with for a while was that because the student was doing an exercise, had other people behind them playing aircraft, mm-hmm. so that if they were up to snuff, they could help out the person that was actually doing the exercise and being marked on, mm-hmm. which isn't very helpful because you want to see what the person that is doing the exercise can do. Right. You don't need help in the background because they don't learn and you're just messing up the system. Mm-hmm. And they could help, and in a couple of cases they did. They got the person through. The problem was they went out and they just couldn't manage it. And then this was male and female. Mm-hmm. Just because you like somebody doesn't necessarily mean... we did have a couple of females. They went out with a red flag. Said, "I'm sorry. We don't feel he or she should be an air traffic controller, so beware."
Yeah.
And they didn't. None of them did. The strange thing about the test for spatial orientation, those that didn't meet the minimum requirements on that, none of them ever made it past that. So it was a good mm-hmm. test.
Yeah.
The problem was that we didn't have a large enough sample that you could apply it across the board. Right. Say, "I'm sorry, you sit down, do this test, and you can't. No, I'm sorry, you're just not suited." Mm-hmm. And send them on, because it's like, I guess, medical tests around, you have to have several thousand of them to authenticate or prove out one way or the other.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed the teaching part of it, and right out of the clear blue, some numbney decided to promote me. And I was on there a couple of years, and I promoted me, and they sent me to Kingston, Ontario, to a position that was very glorified. It was called Executive Staff Officer to the National Defense College, mm-hmm. which, in layman's term, was that I was going to be gopher, because the lowest rank in the place was a colonel,
yeah.
a full colonel, or Mm-hmm. But it was interesting too, because it was had people on courses that were coming on to the National Defense College, that were basically, we just said, would say they're streamers, they were on the, should have been on the way up.
Mm-hmm.
But we had Canadians, they were American, air, naval, sometimes marine. We had Brits, New Zealanders, and Australians mm-hmm. on the course. And then there was some of the civilian government positions. Foreign Affairs used to send people. Same with the British had Foreign Affairs things. So it was over 50, usually around 50 to 55 people mm-hmm. with a real varied background. So it was interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting in the sense that they traveled. They would in-house take a part of the world to study, and then go visit that part of the world, which was all set up.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to see a lot of things that probably wouldn't have seen otherwise. Toured the north. Europe was always on. They had a studies that took in behind the Iron Curtain, Romania, Yugoslavia. This was before they were, while they were still behind the Iron Curtain,
mm-hmm.
Into East Berlin, to Israel, Egypt. That was an interesting case in that you had to have two passports because mm-hmm. you couldn't go from Israel to an Arab country.
Oh, yeah.
Unless you went out and landed someplace else and come back, because they didn't like one. Well, of course, they mm-hmm. didn't like one. So that, as I said, was going out. I had 60-some-odd people. We had our, when we went internationally or around the world, had our own aircraft. We had a 707 all to ourselves, only. 60-some-odd seats. Works out pretty nice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when I was traveling, I could sit in on all the talks that were given to the this what did we call them? They weren't students. Anyway, they were basically that's what they were doing. They were sitting in class and briefings. So then gone for 30, 40 some odd days at a time. We did the round the world. We went from Trenton to Alaska to Tokyo. Took the fast train to Nagoya, the bullet, at 200 kilometers an hour.
Yeah,
it was that was in 1975.
Yeah.
Then to Bali, to Singapore, Kuala Lumpur. And then we had to do a long flight because the government at the time was not talking to India because of the CANDU reactor system. So we had to fly around it to go to Tehran in Iran. And, of course, of all the places in the world you would go, have an unserviceability, it would be Tehran. But the Americans were still there then.
Right.
And from there, we went to Nairobi, to the Ivory Coast, to French, well, it was basically French, but it was on the Ivory Coast. Memorable thing about it was that it's on the equator, it's at sea level, and everybody dressed up in suits and stuff. Just died. So from there we flew across the Atlantic to Jamaica. Stayed there for a couple of days, and then it was time to go back to Trenton, land in Trenton, go back to Kingston, and prepare for the next outing.
Right.
So my job basically was make sure all the luggage got moved, pay all the bills, make sure the transportation was available. Because we're traveling in and out of a whole bunch of different countries, we call them grunks, that's just different kinds of money. Mm-hmm. So before we leave any country, they all came and gave me all their money. And they converted the exchange rate back into their money so that they got credit for it. And we went around, it was a nightmare. And there's nothing stingier than a bunch of high-paid people. So, anyway, thing is that on that I got to hobnob with some fairly significant people in the military, and who went on and became, the chief of the defense staff or chief of the Air Force.
Yeah.
And after Kingston, I was only there for about 16 months, I guess. And one of their staff was retiring. He thought it would be nice if they changed it, that job that I was doing, to a civilian. And I had to move again.
Right.
So, out of the clear blue, I got transferred to Summerside, PEI, which was nice. Had only, like, 6 weeks because they wanted me there because somebody was going someplace. And I went there totally out of air traffic control again. And I went in there as the personnel services officer, which, again, was really interesting because they had a responsibility for the messing staffs, recreation, messing, aviation, all those ancillary things, which again was interesting. It was totally different, so I think. And of course, not long after I got there, the base commander had a boy, I can't remember what happened to him. But anyway, he got very ill, So the boss that I was working for, he had to go in and be acting base commander. Mm-hmm. So I got bumped up to the base admin officer's position. And that went on for 6 months or so. So I was really floundering out there because it was a lot of different areas of responsibility I had never had really much to do with other than use their services.
Right.
So it was interesting in the type of aircraft we were doing, maritime patrols with the Argus search and rescue, and which was the main thing. But the air crew, one of the biggest feedbacks I got from the Argus flights was that they go for 15 to 18 hours of trips. And if their food rations got mixed up, talk about being upset.
Yeah.
The worst one thing, you forgot the peanut butter. Okay. So what is initiated there, both because of the kitchen staff who put these kits all together and all they did was pick them up and take them to the aircraft, was to get a rotation going for the kitchen staff to go on one of the trips to see what it was like to go away for anywhere up to 16, 18 hours.
Yeah.
And basically that was the only entertainment they had, was either on station doing their jobs or cooking.
Mm.
And they got to be pretty popular because they themselves got an experience they'd never had before.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, cooking, this is not so bad. And then they could see if they're missing the frying pan or something like that. It was pretty serious business out there. So that came to, I think I was there until I was 75 through 79. And out of the blue, I got moved back to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
To Baden-Sillingen as the base air traffic control officer. So that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And here comes Munchkin. As the base air traffic control officer, which I'd been away from air traffic control now for a number of years, I think.
Okay.
But I had really good people. I mean, the second in charge could have just as easily been do the job that I was going to do because he'd already done it.
Right.
Again, it was CF-100s. Totally CF-100s at the base in Baden-Slingen. We had the same sort of exercises, OPA battles, they call them. Got involved to go away and do OPA battles at other bases in the air traffic side of it.
Mm-hmm.
Great spot. There's no bad restaurants around Baden. And Baden was just downtown. Baden-Sillingen was the air base. You could see France. It was from the tower. It was just across the river.
Yeah.
Very interesting flying. Most of the stuff that we did was low level. The dividing line between France and the German side was the center line of the Rhine River, and you see aircraft floating up and down going like this. I got to fly a few times over there in the 104, and I don't know if you've ever heard of 104 or not. Really noisy. It's where, you're inside of it, there is no noise.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally silent inside, noise is all out the back.
Yeah.
But very interesting. Flying up and down valleys, they seldom. They do most of their flying low level, so you're down between the peaks. And again, it's right side. We call it right side separation.
Mm-hmm.
People coming that way are on that side thing, and you're flying down there, and all of a sudden there's just blurs went past you.
Wow.
I said, ooh. And I said, we got back after landing. I said, you guys complain about not knowing about some traffic that's in our circuit. And you fly up and down here, and nobody knows they're coming or going. All they see is a blur. You know something went past you.
Right.
But I don't know. I got a picture upstairs of Hohenzollern Castle. I had to look up to see it. We were flying down the valley. So I guess the biggest thing I did over there, I volunteered for an extra year, and I was accepted to stay in my job. I was not popular. Somebody else wanted my job, I guess. But I didn't feel badly about taking the extra year. It was an opportunity, certainly for the family, to travel. They had a great travel system over there, both on the economy, as we call it, which is the Germans are the on the base, had their own buses, and they had tours going all over the place all the time. So they just crawl on the bus, and it was a guided tour. It was really good. So Kathy could go when she wanted to, and I couldn't always get away. So my son was going to high school over there. So again, they was between the school and different trips. It was a really, well, you couldn't afford to do it any other way.
Right. Yeah. Experience. How did you find just personal interactions with those that you were working with? Were things generally, I don't know the word. Well, was it easy, or were there challenges in that?
I always worked with the philosophy that there's no way you can keep everyone happy. So the opposite side of the coin was to try and keep everyone equally unhappy. there are some people you can't, but work on the basis that since you can't make everyone happy, try and keep the rest of the pretty even keel. Now, you don't always manage to do that, but generally speaking, I think it worked reasonably well.
Okay.
Somebody's always going to be mad at somebody else. I mean, it's trying to smooth over the sore spots or anything. And some of it is not always the men. It's some of the ladies. You know, because I was commissioned from the ranks. Most of the guys, and that's why we moved quite frequently, especially out there. Most of the guys could overcome that. But the ladies, the wives, some of them, there's just no way, you know, justified or unjustified. And like I said, they didn't even know my wife, but obviously, she's really high mucky. Okay, well, she's not that at all. But it's something you live with. I don't think it's any different than any other place. As I said, to the best of my ability, I worked on a thing no matter where, in what job I was. The equally unhappy scenario. Nobody, you can't get too high, can't get too low.
Right.
Because someone's always going to be unhappy.
Right.
And that's life.
That's true.
And rule number one, you know what that is? Bill Gates, rule number one?
I don't recall.
Life is not fair.
Hmm.
Yeah. And which is pretty true.
That's true.
That's rule number one. So get over it.
Right.
So after Europe, somebody like me in Manitoba again, so they sent me back to the headquarters. Again, not air traffic control. I came back to Air Command headquarters as the senior staff officer cadets. I had oversaw Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Northwestern Ontario, and that's land, air, sea. So you can see, fairly busy, They always want to see the boss. Nobody wants to see the second guy in charge of your work because they all want something. So there was, you always had a, you had the cadets, you have the sponsoring committees, land, air, sea. So there's eight, or land, air, sea, three. So there's six different groups in every province.
Mm-hmm.
Including northwestern Ontario, that to the lakehead was the far side of it. When they're having their meetings, they always like to see somebody from the headquarters. So I was spent an awful lot of weekends traveling, and of course, when I got back, my boss wanted to see me in the office. So while it's very interesting and. That in Prairie Reach also had the cadet camps.
Mm-hmm.
We sent our naval cadets to Comox in the summer. We had a camp in Cold Lake, had a camp in can't think of the name of Penhold, one in Saskatchewan at Green Lake, and so in the summertime, while they're out of school, all these camps are going on. Of course, everybody wants to see how it's going, so
mm-hmm.
you have to visit all the different camps. The only thing I can say about them is that kids were great. Some of the adults that are wearing the uniforms or sponsoring committees just drove you nuts. They're trying, their heart's in the right place, but some of them have checked their mind in someplace else. But the kids were never a problem. The odd one was, because he did a run. You get the odd runner from a camp. Didn't like it, so he took off.
Right.
Which kind of gets mothers and fathers a little upset because you don't know where the little sucker is.
I can imagine.
But most of them were just great, happy to be there. Did great work. Lots of them came into the military after, and they made good candidates because they had been through a lot of the crazy stuff, you know, marching and discipline. They listened well because a lot of them had risen through the ranks, and so they were very much aware of what was going on. And those that were keen were really keen and did very well in the thing. This is after I did that for 3 years, so it was getting a little thin. Because just the amount of traveling, mostly, where is this the weekend? So then from the cadets in Winnipeg, I moved up one floor and went into an organization called Organizations and Establishments, which was managing or trying to track all the positions in the RCAF.
Okay.
And ranks, positions, organization orders for the Canadian Force, or the RCAF at that time. So that was interesting too. Different, but very rewarding. And before I left there, I did the boss wanted the RCAF all reorganized. It still wasn't the RCAF. It was after I left, actually, before the RCAF came back.
Oh, right.
Designation came back in.
Mm-hmm.
We always thought we were RCAF anyway, but did all the reorg and wrote all the orders that some of them, I think, should be still in place today, I would think. They're still organized that way anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that was reorganization. Then I volunteered to go to Comox and go to Colorado Springs. Fell on deaf ears for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. I think largely I was unilingual. After I was promoted to major, got the idea that you couldn't have, you had to have a college degree or a university degree to move ahead. So I just, not having neither, I spent 19 years as a major. But that was, why? Because I think I was just as good as a whole lot of some of them, but if it didn't have the little check mark, no go. So. They finished there in Winnipeg and took my uniform off in March of 1993. And they hired me back to do the same job as a civilian. I stayed there till 2000 and doing the same thing. And then, so after 45 years, I decided that it was time to move on. But I really enjoyed it. One of the things I liked about the military was that you hardly could get into a rut because they'd ask you to do something else.
It seems that way, yeah.
A lot of people didn't like that. You know, they become comfortable. But there's a whole new world out there if you want to take it on. And sure, there's an expectation, but none of it can't be learned or, you know, you pitch in and get it going. One of the things that just at the end was becoming computers and everything are coming in, never did really get it really caught into them because it just wasn't, time, and the computer, as far as I had, was a pencil, an eraser on the end of it, was the best computer you had. But it's, as I said, anybody that says, even after, anybody that says there's nothing to do, just isn't trying very hard.
Right, that makes sense. But
I really enjoyed the military. If it's hard on anything, it's hard on your families. One is the moving, different school systems. But the military, no matter where you went, the rules and regulations were the same. Just so you were not being operated other than location. While a lot of the families admitted it is tough on them. They learned a lot too. Got to see a lot of things you would probably not see. Met a lot of people. A lot of them still have their own school friends and stuff that they met there. They said, "Oh, can't move with my friends." But you know, a week after you were someplace else, I said, "Where's your brother? Oh, I got some friends." You know, and did this new friends. And a lot of them met one another again after because it was air. It was air.
Well, speaking of the challenges of moving so much, it sounds like your training was pretty consistent throughout your career. There was many new opportunities for more training.
Yeah, anybody that joins the military and thinks he's out of school is so sadly mistaken. It's literally all really back to school. It's a constant learning curve. There's particularly now, I mean, those are the major courses, but there's first aid, there's all the courses now you need for whether what do they call them? Social graces, you know, every time there's something happens, you have to have another course. I can't think of the word right now, but
Just like cultural sensitivity.
Yeah, those things. Yeah. Yeah. Every time there's anything that happens, there's a course on it.
Right.
The thing sometimes you wonder, the same with the police force. Everything, something happens, say, well, you need more training. There's a point in time where you can't do any of the work that you're supposed to do if you're always on a training scenario. There was that training, there was always weapons training, NBC, nuclear biological warfare, first aids, courses on the sensitivity training. Any time something come up, well, we have another course. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole bunch of blocks. Check it off. Doesn't mean that they absorbed a lot. It just means that, well, they've got you by the short curlies because you think you've had it. Mm-hmm. If you blow it. But that almost anything that would come up, either yourself, inflicted training, just delving into it or researching it. So, I mean, literally the military is just one long course that you're on.
Right. Do you have any things looking back that you think you would have maybe done differently or changed?
No, I don't think so. I've always, from the time, I guess, I was lucky in getting the selection into the occupation that I did initially, it suited me. I enjoyed it. My eyesight initially wasn't good enough for aircrew, so it was as close to flying as you could get was talking to them or telling them where to go. Mm-hmm. So that, I enjoyed the differences, or doing different things, different times. Every place that you go to, well, there's always, seems to be downsides. Usually there's the upsides are better than the downsides. I was never one of those people, and I knew a number of them, that they were only happy in the last place they were at. They were never happy where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you see people like that too, mm-hmm. at university and stuff. Is that just they're all downers? You say, well, please, why do you do this?
Yeah.
Sort of thing. So. I don't know whether it's upbringing my on the farm. You were just expected to pitch in, do your share. Didn't matter whether it was outside or inside the house. Mother had a broom. You didn't want her to get after you.
Sure.
But as far as we growing up, when. The evening came because there was no power and there was light, but we used to have to knit mittens and socks and listen to the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't listen to the radio too long either because then the battery wore out.
Oh.
But just expected to pitch in and do everything, and I've always, I guess, been basically so inclined, and that's father would show you something to do it once. He would then forget how to do it. So you
right.
had to carry on.
Mm-hmm.
But a certain amount of cooking. Certainly, mother had us well trained in cleaning. I had two sisters. She couldn't used to drive her nuts. So my brother and I used to have to do it more often than we would like to. But.
Have you kept up with command and control currently?
Well, I belong to the Aircrew Association, also do RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute. So we have some very good speakers keeping up with military aspects of it, and periodicals and things like that, that I follow that. Because of the number of people that I knew throughout, we have a number of them here, and I think we have common interests and stuff. So, and I'm president of the association here. I do the Vancouver Island Strata Owners Association. I'm involved there. I retired federal employees. I guess it keeps me relatively busy and volunteering. As I said, if you want volunteer work, you can get as much as you want. And all of it, most of it's interesting.
Yeah. Do you have thoughts on where command and control operations are going in the future, or do you have opinions on how things have changed?
Well, certainly they've changed. One of the things I guess most of us old crocs find discouraging is that support internally, like they treat it, it seems that it's treated too much like an 8-to-5 job. And the camaraderie, I don't think it's the same anymore as it used to be with activities. They don't join anything anymore. Even we try and get, you know, there's lots of air crew around here. Sure, some of them are working. But even those that are retired are retiring now. Don't seem to want to be involved for whatever reason.
Interesting.
That's why I find Rusi and this air crew is that they're involved in it. They're still keeping current with activities and speakers and stuff. We get some really very good speakers that have, with Afghanistan, we had a lot of people that were coming back. They were either visiting here. We get the commander, Maritime Command, comes out to hear him. Anytime there's a high-ranking official around, we usually try and buttonhole him to come and speak. Some of the university, there's Jim Bootley, I think he's teaches at what's the college, Pearson?
Oh, yeah.
Up there. He's an excellent speaker on the Far East and activities over there, keeps us apprised. We just had the Northwest Passage, a guy that's spoke very knowledgeable about it. So in that sense, you know, in Keep Au Fait, we get periodicals from our sister Rusi organizations around the world. Some very good articles. Makes us feel pretty poor. Some of them get more support than we do. But military history, obviously, we think that's great and should be carried on. As long as it's physically possible.
Sure. Well, in wrapping up this interview, is there anything else you'd like to discuss that hasn't been covered?
I don't think there's just much more I could say. But I've been out now for quite a long time.
Okay. Oh, sorry.
I'm going to make sure I get all my pension this due me.
Good. As you should. well, at this point, I'll get you to sign the interview release form. I think I have
that. I got it. Here.
Okay. Right on this, if you'd like.
You know, the full name or just...
Sure. Whatever you prefer. You usually go by Ray?
Yeah. You can... University of Victoria, what, where do you...
Yeah, I can finish that if you just do your signature there, yeah.
And today is...
13th.
I wish I had a nickel for every signature I had when I was in cadets.
Oh, yeah. I can imagine. I'll just sign two if I...
Oh.
Thanks.
Yeah, I've got another interview at 12:30.
Oh, really?
The Canadian Longitudinal Studies for the Aging.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's really neat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I'll just have to read out loud that we have both signed the interview release form. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yes. And this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Major James R. Weber on March 13th, 2017.